Pengo was to testify in Sela on January 19th. He had received ample warning from his lawyer that he should tell the absolute truth, and he planned to comply in his own way. But rather than get nervous, he decided to approach his time on the witness stand as pure theater. So he gathered a small group of friends, most of them from Berlin's punk scene, and drove from Berlin to Hanover. Once the group arrived at another friend's place in Hanover, an all-night party ensued, with the consumption of copious hash. Pengo and his entourage were in some disrepair when they arrived at the Sela courtroom. Dressed in his standard black jeans, black turtleneck, and heavy black boots, Pengo strode to the witness table and began to answer questions. "How old are you?" asked the presiding judge. 21, Pengo replied haltingly. "Your profession?" "Programmer." Since 1985, Pengo said, he had been working as a programmer and studying computer science at the Technical University in Berlin. "What semester are you in?" the judge asked. At a loss, Pengo reached into his pocket and pulled out his student identification. 8th, he pronounced after consulting the document, and laughter rippled through the courtroom. Pengo might have figured that he had little to lose by being cheeky in the courtroom. He was there strictly as a witness and not as a defendant. In his own investigation, it looked as if he would soon be in the clear, the charges against him dropped. Besides, he was happy to put on something of a show for his friends. One of them, a young woman with hair dyed violet, was the object of a budding romantic interest. Pengo's refusal to yield in the slightest to those in authority, especially in a nation so conscious of rules and regulations, carried with it a certain perverse appeal. Pengo was someone who wasn't frightened to speak his mind, to shrug off a rebuke. Those authorities born and raised in West Germany who were involved in the case, Kohlhaas, Judge Spiller, even Pengo's own relatively conservative lawyer, might have explained away Pengo as a product of the chaotic sensibilities that dominated West Berlin. But they could just as easily have rationalized his behavior by saying he was part of a generation that had managed to divest itself of the exhausting and burdensome thing known as the German past. If post-war Germans hated the Nazis and their children hated the Soviets, many of those in Pengo's generation could only be described as indifferent. Pengo recounted his first meeting with Hagbard at the Chaos Gathering at the end of 1985. "For Hagbard, hacking was a skill with political relevance," Pengo said. His belief was that you have just one chance in your life to influence world politics, and with all this hacking knowledge in hand, this was it. Pengo also told of the seeds of the idea, his trip with Peter Karl to East Berlin, and of the meeting with Sergei. "We went to a restaurant afterwards and talked about God and the world," Pengo testified. After that first trip, Pengo testified, he waited for Sergei's feedback. To his great disappointment, none came, and by the beginning of 1987, Pengo's role in the enterprise had fizzled. Karl continued to drop by for coffee and to ask him for source code, but Pengo couldn't deliver them. "The whole thing was more hot air than anything else," he declared. After a while, Karl stopped calling. By that summer, Pengo said, he and Dobb were no longer speaking, and he had never had much contact with Hess. Hagbard, he said, was completely outgespaced, talking of nothing but conspiracies and having religious hallucinations. Once, Pengo recounted, when he and Hagbard were on a train together that was traveling 180 kilometers per hour, Hagbard wanted to open the train doors and jump out. Pengo turned himself into the authorities, he said, not because his conscience weighed on him or because of a recognition of a moral breach, but because he had to find a way to get myself out of this mess. It was the first time Pengo had had any direct contact with his erstwhile friends Karl and Dobb in nearly 2 years. Both defendants sat next to their lawyers and frowned. Dobb barely moved, only occasionally reaching up to play absent-mindedly with his beard. The judge's questioning turned to Pengo's hacking career. "Where have you hacked?" "I've been all over the world," Pengo answered. "Which companies have you hacked?" "I don't know," Pengo said. "The computers don't tell me what companies they're from." "Did you share the passwords you got with others?" "No, I always kept the passwords I had for myself." "How many did you have?" Pengo took a moment to consider this one. "In the course of my active hacking time, maybe 50 or 100? Pengo then decided to bring up the science fiction that had inspired him in this esoteric enterprise. He described John Brunner's Shockwave Rider and William Gibson's Neuromancer and their cyberpunk antiheroes. "Did the people in the books get a lot of money?" the judge asked, clearly missing whatever point Pengo was trying to make. Pengo's friends in the back of the courtroom giggled. "The chief thing for me was the adventure, suddenly being inside a movie." Then it came time to ask about the SecurePack software that Pengo had stolen from Digital's Singapore computer. A witness from Digital had already testified that it was difficult to put a market price on the security program, as it was restricted to Digital's internal use, but it had cost $375,000 to develop. Digital had also sent a lawyer from its Munich office to sit at the trial every day. She was particularly interested in Pengo's testimony. There seemed to be some confusion on the judge's part over whether Pengo had copied the software once in late 1986 and a second time a few months later. The computer kept track of the last time the software had been worked with and not the time it was copied out of Singapore. So when SecurePack was found inside the reconstituted Rainbow, February of 1987 referred to the last time Pengo had looked at the software and nothing more. But he couldn't seem to make that clear to the judge. "Did you copy SecurePack twice?" asked the judge. Like Dobb, Pengo was short on patience when it came to explaining the fine points of modifying software. "Why should I copy it twice from Singapore when I have a complete version in Berlin?" Pengo thought he had done pretty well. His friends thought so too. In fact, he seemed to be emerging barely scratched from the espionage ordeal. It was an ordeal that had landed two of the others in jail for nearly a year, plunging Dobb into irretrievable depression and causing Peter Carl's ex-wife to cut off what little remaining contact he had with her and their daughter. A third had taken his own life. Marcus Hess, the wily hacker of LBL, was the only other one whose life had proceeded on a relatively steady course. Though Hess viewed Pengo as ice cold, and Pengo wanted little to do with someone of Hess's conservative nature, they were in some ways similar. Their middle-class upbringings and concerned parents had given them a sense that they could negotiate their way out of tight spots. Their styles were different, but they were both able to enlist sympathy and help. Hess had the more traditional upbringing, but both knew better than the others how to manipulate the system to their own ends. Cliff Stoll was to testify on January 30, 1990. It was Stoll's testimony that Marcus Hess at once dreaded and awaited eagerly. Depending on what Stoll might say, the American's testimony could incriminate Hess more than Hess's own testimony. On the other hand, Hess planned to engage Stoll in a match of technical wits. By late 1989, Stoll was in some disfavor among his colleagues in the U.S. Some of his peers questioned his talent as a computer scientist, which shouldn't have been surprising since he had never claimed to be one. Stoll was by no means the first system manager to have successfully beaten a hacker at his own game, and he certainly wasn't the first to impart a small but invaluable warning to the computer community at large. When choosing passwords, don't choose something obvious such as your spouse's name or your dog's name or even an English word. Other security experts had been saying that for years, but Stoll somehow struck a nerve. His unorthodox personality had made him a perfect media icon. He had written a breezy first-person book about his zealous hunt for the odious hacker that became a bestseller, and for several weeks he was a fixture on television talk shows. There was no avoiding his message. The nation's computers were at risk. When Stoll arrived in Sela, he was flanked on one side by an FBI special agent, whom the West German spectators assumed was a bodyguard, and on the other by an American public television crew filming a documentary on the amazing hacker catcher from Berkeley. First, the judge asked Stoll to simply tell the story of what had happened at the Berkeley laboratory in late 1986. Stoll had already spent the better part of a year refining his story and was happy to tell it once again, starting with the 75-cent discrepancy and ending with the news from West Germany in June 1987 that the hacker had been caught. Gesturing wildly and speaking through an interpreter, Stoll relived for the judges, the prosecutor, and the spectators his alarm and concern as he saw the hacker break into military computers and search for specific military information. As soon as Stoll began to tick off the military sites the hacker had been in, the judges started scribbling notes. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory, MITRE Corporation, Anniston Army Depot, the Redstone Army Missile Base in Alabama, and an Army computer at the Pentagon. The hacker searched for such hair-raising words and phrases as nuclear, strategic air command, and stealth bomber. "Excuse me," interrupted the judge. "What does stealth mean?"
"I consider myself lucky that I don't know what it means," answered Stoll.
And, just as he had done the previous summer before the police in Meckenheim and the magistrate in Karlsruhe, in court in Sela, Stoll used such words as copy and printout to describe what he saw happening on his computer screen in Berkeley.
"As an astronomer, I wasn't all that familiar with military stuff," Stoll said, "so it surprised me to see space shuttle information being copied out."
Once he had planted the false SDI net inside the LBL computer, Stoll testified, the hacker spent several hours copying it back to his own home. This was the very point on which Hess and his lawyer were poised to attack Stoll's credibility. Hess's lawyer spoke up. "We seem to be having some trouble with the language," the defense attorney said. "Herr Stoll, what is really meant with print and copy?" Stoll began to bounce in his seat. "Excellent question, excellent, excellent," he exclaimed, as if he were in front of a freshman computer science class, encouraging a clever student. "To print means to look at, to list, or to see." Once that point had been set straight, it was clear that what Stoll had said in his testimony during the summer, and what he was repeating in the Sela courtroom, was scant proof that the hacker was downloading and storing anything at all. It could well have been months of browsing. Mere electronic joyriding and nothing more. Prosecutor Kohlhaas saw his case weaken. Stoll's testimony lasted nearly 3 days. Most of that time, Stoll spent reciting page after page of his logbook. Exact dates and times of the break-ins were of particular importance, as German telephone officials were expected to come to court immediately after Stoll's testimony with corroborating evidence matching the dates and times of their telephone traces to Marcus Hess with the dates and times in Stoll's logbook. On the final day of Stoll's testimony, it was the defendant's turn to interrogate the witness. Neither Dobb nor Carl had much to ask Stoll. Hess, on the other hand, was ready for some confrontation, a battle of technical prowess. Hess first asked Stoll if it wasn't true that he had little way of knowing that it was the same hacker inside the computer each time. Stoll agreed that there were some break-ins that occurred on VMS computers, not Unix computers, and that with the exception of the traces made directly to Hanover, he had no way of knowing that it was the same hacker each time. Hess also wanted to know if Stoll's SDINet file was his and Martha's own invention entirely. Hess's motive, apparently, was to provoke Stoll into admitting that he was in league with the FBI or the CIA. Hess would maintain to the end that the FBI had assigned Laszlo below to ask for the information in order to speed up the pace of the investigation. Stoll's answer was curt. "It was fictitious," Stoll responded, "but I tried to make it look as realistic as possible." Hess wouldn't give up. He questioned Stoll's typing rhythms experiment. How could this prove anything given the great distance? Any unique characteristics would certainly be lost, he suggested, in the labyrinth of networks between Germany and California. Stoll countered that he had believed the validity of his experiment. The interrogation at times required that Hess and Stoll gather in front of the bench. Together they bent over computer printouts to examine the details of their arguments. It was odd to see the hunter and the hunted analyzing documents like two academic colleagues. One morning, before court was in session, Stoll and Hess happened to arrive before anyone else. It was an awkward but cordial encounter. Hess suggested that the two get together for a beer sometime. Stoll, an outspoken non-drinker, nodded politely and excused himself. By the time Stoll's testimony in Sela had ended, it was unclear whether he had helped or hurt the prosecution. Ask Stoll what he considered to be the ultimate value of his sleuthing, and he would say, "Chasing the bastards down." For his part, Kohlhaas was grateful for the existence of Stoll's logbook, and pleased that Stoll had kept such careful note of the times the hacker had been inside LBL. Otherwise, the Bundespost's telephone traces would have been difficult to present in court as incontrovertible evidence. Then again, Kohlhaas had to admit that establishing Hess as the LBL hacker
wasn't as relevant to the espionage charge as proving that the information he had seen had gone to the Soviets, and no one would know until the verdict was delivered how the testimony was viewed by the judges. For the judges to impose stiff sentences, the prosecution had to demonstrate that sensitive military information had changed hands. Prosecutor Kohlhaas's efforts to bring a U.S. military expert to Sela to assess the sensitivity of the material had ended in frustration, and in the end, Hagbard's testimony to the police, in which he had claimed that hundreds of logins to sensitive U.S. and European computers went to the East, was stricken from the record for lack of credibility. At the time Marcus Hess was caught, the media were making him and his friends out to be half the KGB, when in reality, Hess was a fairly conventional young man who claimed to take inspiration from a movie. As notorious as the hacker spies became, the judges would have to admit that the defendants really did very little damage to Western security. In the end, the only person who was damaged irretrievably was Hagbard. So it wasn't a great surprise when the sentences turned out to be light. Peter Carl, whom the court viewed as the one most actively engaged in espionage itself, and the one who exhibited the most criminal energy, got 2 years and a 3,000 mark, $1,500 fine. Hess was sentenced to a year and 8 months and ordered to pay 10,000 marks. Dobb got a year and 2 months and a 5,000 mark fine. But instead of having to serve prison time, all three defendants were put on probation. At the time of their actions, the judges remarked, Dobb and Carl were operating in such a drug-filtered haze that they were in no position to recognize the gravity of their deed. In his conclusions to the court, presiding Judge Spiller said he believed the hackers had indeed sold information out of military computers to the KGB, and that the KGB had probably found the information very interesting. But, he added, Sergei couldn't have seen it as terribly valuable because he didn't yield to the hackers' demands for 1,000,000 marks. In the end, all that hacker know-how went unappreciated, even by the Soviets.